Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Reyes, Judge Connolly, Judge Klopagy, the Honorable Peter M. Reyes, Jr. presiding.
Good morning. You may be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Thursday, November 9th, 2023. We have six cases on our calendar today, three of which are set for oral argument. The first of which is A23-0087, Emily Lynn Rasmussen versus Nicholas Stephen Rasmussen. Counsel for appellant, you will have 15 minutes for your initial arguments, 15 minutes for respondent, and 5 minutes for appellant on rebuttal, if you so choose. You can use the podium in the middle, and there is a button underneath to lower and raise it, and you can also lower and raise the microphone. Please be cognizant of the the clock. There's a clock on the podium as well, so that you know how much time that you have, and try to stay within your time limit. With that, counsel for appellant, you may begin.
May it please the court. My name is John Burns, and I represent the appellant, Nicholas Rasmussen. These parties were divorced in 2017. At that time, they were granted joint legal and joint physical custody of their minor child, and Mr. Rasmussen was ordered to pay total child support of $997 per month. 4 years later, the total support was lowered to $835 per month. Then in August of 2022, Mr. Rasmussen filed motions to further modify his child support obligation. These requests were denied by the child support magistrate, and that decision was subsequently ratified by the district court. On appeal, we raised three issues. Number one, that the CSM abused her discretion when she misapplied the law and gave respondent a non-joint child deduction from income for an unborn child. Number two, that the CSM abused her discretion in concluding that respondent's health insurance coverage was most appropriate. And ultimately, number three, that the CSM abused her discretion in refusing to modify child support. The first error that I'd like to deal with is that of the deduction for the unborn child. In determining child support, a parent is entitled to a deduction from gross income if they are, quote, legally responsible for a non-joint child. But that needs to be the actual circumstances at the time of the motion to modify.
If the trial court was wrong on that item, you still wouldn't get to your 20% and $70, would you?
We would. The analysis on the numbers concludes that if we prevailed on my client providing the health insurance,
But without the health insurance issue on just the child, you wouldn't get there, would you?
I would agree. Okay. That yes, we prevail if we get both the unborn child and the insurance, or if we just get the insurance. That would be accurate mathematically.
So if that's the case, then would even if we were to agree with you, is that essentially harmless error then? If you only prevail on the non-joint and not on the
it's still an error. It's still an abuse of discretion. The statute, effectively the court has rewritten the law, CSM, by saying someone that is expecting a child in 3 months should get the deduction for gross income. Now, ironically, the history of this case, in that first modification that I referenced in my opening, my client and his wife were expecting a child in 2 months, and they didn't get one. So that shows the nature of applying this prospectively and the danger with it. And that's why...
I'm not sure it shows the danger if the statute has ultimately been changed to allow for that particular situation.
Sure, but it has not. The language in the statute is clear. It says under 518A.39 The actual circumstances at the time of the motion to modify must allow for the legal responsibility of the non-joint child. So that statute says you take a snapshot right at that moment. And if you don't qualify, whether you're expecting one day later or 8.5 months later, you don't get it. And so that's the misapplication.
Is there a case law that supports your argument on that issue as well?
There is. In our brief, I lay that out. Again, I'm relying heavily on the statute. That's 518A.39, subdivision 2B1. When I sit down between arguments, Judge, I'll try to find you the case law page and citation as well.
Morning. Is it the Mashoff versus Lighting case?
I believe it is. Okay. I believe it is. That's correct. Thank you. So for that reason, the non-joint child application should not have been made. But moving on to my second issue, which is critical because of the insurance has the bigger modification potential in this case. The CSM abused her discretion in concluding that respondents' health insurance coverage was more appropriate. So in determining coverage, the law says you're supposed to look at the affordability, the accessibility, and the comprehensiveness.
Is that an exclusive list?
It is an exclusive list. That's correct. And that's important because what the court did is the court veered into looking at past history of the parties on how well they communicated or how well they worked together and used that as a basis to deny the request for the modification. And that's not found anywhere in statute or case law.
The court kind of put that in the category of accessibility, I think.
They did. But if you look at the accessibility, that simply is not a factor within that level. The parties share joint legal custody. And so the court erroneously stated the law by saying that if I allow Mr. Rasmussen to be the supplier of the health insurance, then he would be allowed to control access to information about the coverage and the child's health. And that simply isn't the case. That misstates the law.
Because
the parties share joint legal custody, and as a result, the joint legal custody means that they have equal access to medical...
Were there some other language in the original decree that described the responsibilities of both parents relating to appointments and so on?
Not that I can recall, okay. No. This case simply made an award, like in many cases, I guess in 2017, 6 years ago, it just said joint legal, joint physical. And because of that joint legal designation and the law that does apply, there is an equal access. And so concerns moving forward do not fall within any category of those exclusive three that are listed.
The trial court has some concern about his changing jobs.
That's correct. And the court fits that... into its analysis. The law says, as it relates to that issue, that, if you just give me a moment here, that goes to accessibility as well, Your Honor. So Minnesota Statute 518A.41, subdivision 3.2, says that Mr. Rasmussen's insurance is presumed accessible if he can be expected to remain employed for a reasonable period of time. And the CSM made a clearly erroneous finding when she said that he had changed jobs three times, when in fact it had been two times over a six-year period of time, and he stayed on the same career path that he had started on originally. So the reality is that clearly erroneous finding combined with the statutory determination that he absolutely is expected to remain employed for a reasonable period of time, no evidence to the contrary was ever provided, that his job was at risk, that he had had bad reviews, anything of that nature.
When was the last job changed in terms of time?
I don't know that the court detailed it. I was the lawyer at the lower level. My recollection is it had been several years But there had been the two changes that were designated. I know that there was a detail that would answer that question, Your Honor, in my client's affidavits that were submitted, where he lays that out.
You said two changes. So that means two changes, meaning three different jobs.
He had a job at the time. Yes, he changed two times in 6 years. That is correct.
Right. I think that's consistent with what the district court had said in terms of having three different positions. There are two changes, but three different positions that father had held.
I don't have that exact language in front of me. My recollection is that the statement was that there had been three jobs, as in three more jobs.
I had interpreted it as three jobs.
I understand.
Two changes and three jobs. And if that's the correct correct interpretation, I think that's actually consistent with what you are saying. In terms
your
of
argument
two changes.
Is that all of that is irrelevant on the question of accessibility.
That is correct, because as long as there's not some imminent likelihood of losing employment or changing employment or inability to hold employment, and that was going to pull the insurance away and therefore not be dependable, no evidence of that was provided.
Well, isn't the evidence of changing jobs of one parent versus the other parent having the same position throughout the entire time, why isn't that, based on what you said, why isn't that a factor that the district court can look at?
Because that would expand unreasonably upon 518A.41, which again...
But you had said that if there was concern about somebody either not being able to maintain or having had to change jobs because of, you know, being lost the position or being fired, but why can't that include even if somebody who voluntarily switches jobs and not knowing if that insurance is going to, in fact, be maintained because that person may switch jobs again, maybe for, you know, greater opportunity,
right,
a better opportunity. Nothing wrong with that at all.
Right.
So it's not a critique of a person switching jobs, but the fact of the matter is if somebody is switching jobs at a fairly regular basis versus somebody who doesn't, why can't the court consider that as to the stability of having just one insurance?
Right. Simply because the statute limits it to whether the insurance can be whether the person can be expected to remain employed for a reasonable period of time. And so when you put, you know, the reasonable period of time in there, I suppose it goes to your analysis. But the reality is I think people would be hard-pressed with all the job changes and such with COVID and the like to say that two changes in 6 years makes him unreasonable. And again, that he's following his career path. You know, everything is a promotion or a better opportunity, as his affidavit details, when he is moving on to the next position.
There was some question about deductibility, is it copay or deductibles on the two policies?
There was. So that went to the cost of it. And Respondent's counsel has argued that the CSM found her insurance to be more affordable, but that's absolutely not the case. If you look at page 5 of her order, found on the addendum, page 7 of my brief, the CSM did not find respondent's insurance was less costly or more affordable. The entire analysis reads as follows. Although respondent's dependent coverage has a higher premium, it has no deductible, and the cost of prescriptions and office visits are reasonable, close quote. But the bottom line is that by forcing the parties to keep respondents' higher premiums, they've increased the coverage by $1,400 per year. And the court abused its discretion in ordering that respondents' insurance be court-ordered and that appellant would therefore need to pay and continue to pay $243 per month in medical support. Taking the non-joint unborn child and the insurance issue and making the changes that we've asked for would lead the court to then find that with those needed edits, the CSM abused her discretion by refusing to modify the child support. I do want to admit that in my original brief, I mistakenly used the 2023 calculator. I corrected that. and provided the court with the math in my reply brief on page 6, so that the total calculated support under the previous order of $835 per month gets modified to $490 per month, a savings of $345 or 44%. And to pick up on the question that I was first asked, even if the non-joint child issue remains, we still get a $307 reduction or 37%. And accordingly, the presumptions of the statute about it being unreasonable and unfair do apply to this case. And for those reasons, we would ask that the decisions be reversed and remanded. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And we do appreciate the correction, the reply brief, and you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you all have 15 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. My name's Tim Lees, and I am Emily Rasmussen. She's now Amundsen. I'm her lawyer. Bottom line, I think, is Mr. Rasmussen just didn't meet his burden to prove a significant change in circumstances to modify the child support.
He didn't reach the presumption?
Correct.
So how does this presumption work? If you don't reach the presumption, can you still have a modification?
Well, that would require some showing, I believe, that the court would have to find, okay, despite that presumption, I'm still going to find it's unreasonable and unfair. That argument was never made. There were no facts put forth.
Question. That was never presented to the district court.
No. Mr. Rasmussen never claimed that there were reasons beyond that made it unreasonable.
If I don't reach the presumption, it's unreasonable and unfair, and this is why.
Exactly. Okay. And I also don't know. It wasn't brief, but just as I'm sitting here listening to arguments and thinking, I don't, you know, child support's made up of three components: basic support, child care support, and medical support. We don't have, but I don't know that you take the entire award and see if that has changed 20% or $75. I think you look at that basic support. Has that changed $75 and 20%? But I'll start with the non-joint child credit. But again, I would submit that this is not a significant issue.
Well, I think it's a significant issue when you have two different rulings, what appear to be inconsistent rulings by the district court.
They do appear to be inconsistent at first blush. That Garrigan case I provided, which is the only case law I could find on this issue, and that's an unpublished case. I'm not telling you you're bound by that. But there, it wasn't an issue of, as Mr. Burns argues, the facts existing at the time that child had not come out of the mother yet. The issue the court was having there was, well, Dad, we don't know if once this child's born, you're going to be legally responsible for this child. We don't know if you're going to have to pay child support. We don't know if the child's going to live with you. I mean, theoretically, we don't even know if he's the father until that child's born and everything's tested. There is a gender difference here, and I know we don't like to distinguish, but with my client being the mother and having the child inside of her and carrying that child and caring for that child, once that child is born, as a matter of law, she is legally responsible for that child. So there's a difference there, I submit.
I think there may be from that perspective, but we're still talking perspective. And do we know for sure mother's actually going to take care of the child? What if mother decides to put up that child for adoption? What if, you know, the child isn't even born? That's still perspective. It seems to be inconsistent when the district court is saying, I'm not going to give credit to father for the child that will be born in 2 months, but I will give mother credit for a child that will be born in 3.5 months. That seems to be inconsistent. That seems to be an error of law, and it seems to be inconsistent with the statute as well.
Well, what the statute says is the circumstances as they exist at the time.
Correct.
And the circumstances that existed was my client was...
There's no child.
So I don't want to get into an argument beyond what we're here for as far as when a fetus becomes a child. Okay? But the court found that this child was going to be imminently born, and my client is caring for that child. Now
but
again...
That seems to be against the... That seems counter to the plain language of the statute, and that's what we have to apply.
Agreed. And that's why I get back to... regardless of whether the court applies that. And listen, I'm not going to dance around that issue too hard. I've thought this through as much as you guys have. It's, yeah.
Well, I doubt that. You know, if we could move on, I mean, I agree with Judge Reyes, it seems like a problem. Could you explain to me what was the reason for keeping the child on mother's insurance? I mean, what I was looking for was like, well, you know, it's a different network, you know, and, you know, we don't like to change doctors. You know, he had a good doctor. I mean, there were some allusions to the child's special needs, but the court didn't even discuss that. So what is the reason for keeping him on the mother's policy when the father's policy seems to be, you know, less expensive?
Well, I think it's more than an argument about... And not necessarily the exact argument they're making, but it's a deeper analysis than, well, whoever's got the cheaper insurance, as long as it pretty much...
No, and I would never agree with... I get that. I mean, cheaper is not... Cheaper can be horrible, but what I'm looking for then, okay, so then why do we want the expensive? I mean, you know, I want the expensive because then I can go to Mayo. I want the expensive one because then, you know, this is the doctor I've had for 30 years, all my kids have this doctor, you know, I don't want to lose this doctor. That's what I was kind of looking for in the court's analysis, and I didn't really see that, Mr. Lees.
No, but I think because what the court was focused on is that accessibility issue. And accessibility doesn't just mean how close you live to the doctor's office. Accessibility is a whole range of things. Is that child going to be able to get care? And equally important, is mom going to be able to access that insurance to provide the care? Is it accessible? Is that child going to get care? And it's more than just counsel saying...
I agree with you, but then, you know, when I think of accessibility to care, I don't think of mother and father don't get along, and therefore, you know, he's not going to... You know, sign the authorizations, or what I was looking for is like, okay, you know, what's the care? How far are they away? Is it about the same? Those are the issues I was looking for. Where are those issues?
But again, if it's more than just, you know, when Mr. Byrne says, well, the court did look at how well they got along together. There's an actual history of some difficult facts here that the court was concerned how this would affect the child's medical care. Things like the father removing the mother's email address and telephone number from the child's dental account. That certainly limits access. If now she's in there, they don't have any record, or she's calling trying to figure out when appointments are, and they're saying you're not...
Well, that was a situation when there were two policies, a potential for two policies covering dental.
And then that mucks everything up.
Yes. Okay.
You know? Father's refused to provide mother information as to the child's appointments. Now, if she's not going to be able to know when an appointment is and go to that appointment, perhaps she has information to share, the child's been complaining of this, well, then the child's not getting care for that. The father's refused to let mother attend some of the child's appointments. The father cancels appointments when the mom schedules them.
Those are really custody kind of questions, though, it seems to me, rather than...
I disagree. If she's got... If let's say, for example, the child fell off the swing set and is complaining about...
Well, my point is this. All of those issues occurred when there was only one policy, and that was mother's policy. So how is going to father's policy going to...
Well, I'm talking medical and dental issues.
Okay.
But for example, if mom says, oh, we better get that shoulder checked out, makes an appointment, and without her knowledge, dad cancels that appointment, now the child's not getting timely treatment for that shoulder and having that looked at. So again.
Well, right, but then going to Judge Klapacki's point, I mean, at that point, you know, A, you could bring a motion for change of custody, you know, based on endangerment, and B, you know, there can be, there are remedies for those problems independent of which insurance it is.
Yeah, as a practitioner for 30 years, saying that I'm going to get a change in custody based on something
you don't think
like
you get
that.
So
no.
The kid breaks his arm.
Mm-hmm.
Mother schedules an appointment to set the arm. Father cancels it. You don't think you're going to get change of custody for endangerment on those facts? I would grant that in a heartbeat.
Change of legal custody.
Yes, thank you.
Boy, I...
Seriously? You've seen that in 30 years? Father cancels an appointment involving the danger, health and danger to the child, and the court says, oh, have a nice day.
No.
I can't believe
no,
that.
But, the clients do get engaged in $20,000-plus litigation, mediation, experts, and you're a year down the road, and it's a very, very difficult, if not... Well, I'm not going to say impossible. It is an extremely difficult thing to change custody, legal or physical.
No, I'm
agree just
with
saying
that,
that's not a reasonable remedy when we've got 8.5 years of steady insurance. Again, the court's concern here was, all right, we've already got these problems with her managing the insurance. We're going to let him manage the insurance now with this history of cutting her off all these things and these difficulties in communication and canceling appointments and all this stuff.
So, counsel, here's my question. I share my colleague's concern about it. This seems to go more to the joint legal custody issue. And we've got, I think, a wealth of precedential and non-precedential case law in which we have upheld a change, a modification of joint legal custody from one parent to another based on endangerment, not just physical, but mental or emotional as well. But putting that to the side for the moment, can you cite to any case law as to that would support your argument that these issues do in fact go to accessibility? Because that's what the district court basically said is these issues of accessibility include the ability of the parent to exercise their joint legal custody rights to care for the child in providing medical and dental.
I did not find that.
Okay.
Can I move to one other subject? The affordability question, the cost of the dependent coverage for father was $178 a month, and mother's was $295. Is that right?
I think the difference, yeah, I always get confused on those numbers. I think the difference was $117 on the premium.
Okay.
But then he's not as specific about...
The CMS also found that the mother's plan had no deductible and had reasonable prescription and office visit costs. Was there a comparison to father's policy on those items?
The court had both of the plans and clearly looked through them both.
Fathers have a deductible and mothers not have a deductible? Is that
yes, fathers had a deductible, though that there was some... One figure in the pleadings, and then some vague testimony from Mr. Rasmussen.
Did both plans cover prescription and office visits?
With or without deductible?
Well, I'm simply trying to...
Yes, they covered.
See, was there a comparison of the two policies on the deductible question and the prescription and office visit costs?
In the order?
I didn't find it in the order. So on the presentation, was there a difference?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So there was no description in the order as to what that difference was. Can you tell me, based upon what was filed, what the record reflects? What I'm trying to determine is how...
I hate to guess, but I thought it was like $3,500 a year.
What I'm trying to determine is how significant to the affordability question is the deductible and the prescription and office visit costs.
Okay. My recollection is that in our presentation to the court, and I didn't do the underlying work on this, but in our presentation to the court reviewing the medical plans, I think his was around $3,500. It's in her affidavit, $3,500 a year. Then there was some testimony without any evidence. Again, it was about 30 seconds of it, of Mr. Rasmussen saying, no, the deductible's $500. So if the court chose to...
Were the part of the policies a part of the record?
The policies were part of the record, but the problem is Mr. Rasmussen never identifies throughout the proceedings which plan he's on, and there's several different plans on there.
But what we have is her testimony that it's $3,500 and his is $500.
Correct.
$3,000 difference in looking from these two people looking at the plans.
Correct. My time is up, unfortunately. Lots to discuss.
Thank you, counsel.
Thanks, guys.
Counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. It's yours.
Thank you. I need to make some corrections. Counsel begins his argument by saying that as he was sitting here, he was wondering how the math is done, whether it's done from just basic support or all areas of the support. The law is clear. It's found at Minnesota Statute 528A.34F, and it is done from the total amount of child support, which is why when I started my argument, I talked about that total amount that Mr. Rasmussen originally had to pay, how it got reduced once, and how we were working down from that $835 number. A second correction here at the end about the deductible that was in this case. She did not have a deductible. He had a $500 deductible. But when you're netting out the cost of the insurance, what makes his more affordable is that her premium was going to be an extra $1,400 per year. So the $1,400 minus the $500 that you have to pay if you use dad's insurance, the parties would still be saving $900 per year.
But that, is that just assuming that there would be only one visit a year?
No. The deductible covers... I don't know where the council was looking at a cost for office visits over and above the deductible. It simply doesn't exist. Once you've met your $500 deductible, there is the same access under either plan. So the only differences are her additional cost and his deductible that has to be satisfied in order to get into the office visits.
And that $500 deductible, that's in the pleadings then?
It is. Okay. It is. It's found in my client's affidavit.
I have a question as a practical matter, because I understand you're hewing to the statute and arguing that it's clear it's very, very limited in terms of what you can look at, but courts are courts of, you want to apply common sense as well.
You do.
And the fact that mother has joint legal custody and has had issues in terms of accessing it and being able to provide child the medical and dental services that should be provided to child, why can't that be part of the accessibility analysis? That seems
right
to logically fit there.
I can see that argument, but what you need to remember is we're in front of a child support magistrate making these arguments. If they wanted to bring an action to change custody, we should have been in district court.
But that's not that wasn't brought, and that's not the issue here.
It was not. No. And I will say that all of the allegations about dad's bad deeds and dad did this and dad did that, there's another side to that story, as there always is. And he's saying, no, that's not accurate. But at the end of the day, the child support magistrate is hewed in on what they're supposed to look at. And it's an analysis of accessibility. It's an analysis that is supposed to go to which insurance policy is better.
But under the accessibility, it also, the statute also does clearly state, quote, the employee can be expected to remain employed for a reasonable period of time.
That is correct.
And why can't the district court take into account the fact that one parent has had three different jobs? That seems to clearly fall underneath that.
I think there's some analysis that needs to be done there, but I think it would need to go further. It would need to say, are you changing career paths? Are you jumping around jobs because you're on?
I don't know if you necessarily need to do that, because the goal is to have consistent care, including consistent medical care.
Sure.
You go to a doctor, you want to have somebody that you can rely on, that they know you know them, and you can go to year after year after year after year.
Right.
If somebody is changing jobs for whatever reason, they can be really good reasons,
right,
beneficial reasons.
Well, did those job changes result in medical and changes in the medical coverage?
In the plan that was available to him, it also resulted in his income going up, which created more income available for the benefit of the minor child.
But that's a different issue than the medical insurance. And when you're changing jobs and you're changing plans and having to change networks,
right,
that's something that clearly on the statute, I think the district court could take into account.
Well, I'd like to know what the record reflects, though. Was there an issue with networks because of job change?
There was not. In fact, when you looked at the comprehensiveness, one of the arguments that the other side made was that because Mr. Rasmussen's coverage was going to be broader and had availability to some of those Mayo Clinic ones and some of the other opportunities, they said that's not a big deal because the child has never needed that in the past. In fact, the whole nature of insurance is to cover what could happen and might happen. And so we think that again, cuts in our favor. And for those reasons, we would ask that that decision originally of the CSM be reversed and remanded as requested. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both, counsel, for your arguments and your briefing. We appreciate it. I'm sure your clients appreciate your strong representation of them as well. We will be issuing an order within the 90-day statutory time frame. Thank you both.